This is WKBW at 1520 on your Buffalo dial.
Liverpool, 1960. Four young men, all from diverse backgrounds, become the Quarrymen, later the Moondogs, later still the Silver Beatles, and finally, the Beatles. They progress from the cavern days of Liverpool to Hamburg and back to England. They tour the United Kingdom, causing little or no reaction. They meet at this point in time three people who are to be instrumental in the sound they'll make, the appearance they'll present, and the success they'll reap. They meet Brian Epstein, proprietor of record stores, a man who prides himself on his ability to manage his affairs, personal and business, with little or no help. They agree that they need a manager. Epstein fits the bill and attempts to get a recording contract. Now here they meet George Martin, who records them and later becomes the most important musical influence in their lives. Prior to meeting Martin, they drop their first drummer, Pete Best, and take on Ringo Starr. Ringo, as Martin explains, is not the greatest drummer in the world, but he's steady. They have hit after hit after hit. They're on their way. Tours, the United States, England, France, Germany, the Far East, the world. They become wealthy, stop touring, stick to the recording studio, and live happily ever after. Or do they? Drugs become a moving factor in their lives. They experiment with pot. They also play with LSD and other hallucinogenic materials. Religious fervor hits Harrison. He discovers a guru. The others follow. Now, the last to leap on this bandwagon is McCartney. He, by the way, is the first to leap off the drug wagon. The guru lasts for a time, but then the urge to work, the urge to create, the urge to do something concrete gives them pause, and they return to the recording studio. Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is conceived. But to this day, we do not know if the version that's on the market is the one that was originally planned. It was during the recording and conception of Sergeant Pepper that McCartney is supposed to have been killed, and so much of Pepper points towards someone's death that the content of the music and the packaging itself may have changed. We do know that Brian Epstein was opposed to the Sgt. Pepper cover as we now see it. We also know that Brian Epstein specifically specified that Sgt. Pepper would be in brown bags rather than the cover we now see. We do know that the cover was approved and released as the Beatles wanted it released after Epstein's death. We know that from this point on, the Beatles lost the controlling agency in their young lives and had little to work with in their personal and business lives, except for the experience they obtained while under Epstein's hard hand. That man who made them change their clothes, wash their hair, be on time, stay out of sight, dress appropriately, be gracious and mannerful, was now gone, and startling things started to happen. The ill-fated venture into filming on their own, Magical Mystery Tour, roundly panned, booed, and criticized by critics all over the world, was a Beatle experiment. The film was a flop, the album a success. Next LP, entitled simply The Beatles, demonstrates the increasingly heavy hand of Lennon coming to the fore and taking over what was at one time the mythical leadership of the group. Lennon stepping in. Lennon filling the vacuum left in their lives, that of being without a controlling force. Lenin, whose earliest history indicates that he is an irreverent man, one who is prone to cruel and practical jokes, and has a morbid sense of humor. The evidence of this presence makes itself more and more manifest as you proceed through the cuts and lyrical content and writings of their albums. Lenin, who today espouses peace and love with the fervence of a man brought back from the very brink of damnation, is this same mind capable of conceiving such a monstrous plot? Paul McCartney is alive and well. Maybe. John Lennon is alive. If I ain't get away,
girl, you know the reason why. November 1966, Abbey Road, the EMI Studios. George Martin, composer, arranger, and producer, sits in a sound lock while the Beatles, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, John Lennon, and Paul McCartney thrash out the words and music and production techniques of an album that's destined to become Sgt. Pepper, Lonely Hearts Club Band. A production hang-up occurs, and while they attempt to thrash it out, an argument erupts, one that might occur between people under pressure and tired. McCartney can't get his point of view across. He leaves the studio tired, depressed, and mentally weary. His footsteps echo through the late night air, and his shoes leave soggy prints in the tarmac that's covered with wet, the result of the rain that the London Weather Bureau tells us came on 22 of November's fall days. An engine roars to life, shattering the still night, and the chirp of the tires as they spin on the wet asphalt signal his leaving. From this point, he drives ostensibly toward home. He pushes the Aston Martin, and the car responds as the accelerator is pressed closer and closer to the floor. There's a light. He misses it. Another vehicle. Accelerator up, brake pedal down, tires straining to the limit of their adhesion. There's a culvert. There's a crash. The Beatles, the three remaining ones, are notified of the crash. And Harrison speeds to the site. Lennon accepts the mantle of leadership and decides they should hush the whole thing up. They talk with George Martin, and it is agreed. Harrison buries the unfortunate Paul. Ringo presides at the service. Martin is nowhere to be found. And Lennon goes into seclusion. Brian Epstein, on learning of the death of Paul, objects vehemently to this plot to keep it a secret. He and Lennon argue strenuously, but Lennon prevails. Shortly thereafter, Epstein, after an abortive attempt at enjoying himself on a country holiday, drives to his residence, locks himself in his room. The chronic insomniac attempts to dose himself to sleep with massive doses of medicine, which kill him.
Number nine, number nine, number nine, number nine, number nine.
By this time, a Paul McCartney look-alike contest has been held, and a certain William Campbell, an orphan from Edinburgh, Scotland, who is a remarkable double, by the way, is the winner. But it is never publicly announced. Campbell is then assumed into the group, and with his bogus identity to this day perpetrates the fraud.
Now, aware that the plot is relatively safe from discovery, the thief begins to revisit the scene of the crime. Clues are left in album covers, and lyrical content points to the macabre secret. Campbell, by the way, submits to plastic surgery, nothing major. The eyebrows are altered to a degree, and he grows a mustache to cover the lack of a small scar on the left upper lip, and the new Paul McCartney is complete. The other Beatles grow facial hair, mustaches as well, so that no one will appear out of the ordinary. Lennon and George Martin proceed to work on a new album. It's called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's the first album since Paul's death, and will be the first one to include clues as to the grisly secret the members of the group carry with them. Let's look at Sgt. Pepper The front album cover has proven to be a mine of macabre visual clues, all pointing to the death of McCartney. Let's look closely. There's a mass of people gathered around the Beatles, twin sets of Beatles, by the way, one in ornate costume in the central part of the picture, and the other set, from Madame Tussaud's Wax Museum, in black clothing. Not the collarless type jackets popularized by the Beatles. They're dressed in black, and two of them smile, while the other two, Paul and especially Ringo, look into the grave in postures of grief. The grave? Yes, in the foreground of the cover. It stretches the width of the cover, and it's headed with the words, Beatles Zero, written in red hyacinths. In the right foreground, there's a bass guitar, left-handed, by the way, in yellow hyacinths and floral greens. Everyone knows McCartney's left-handed, played bass guitar as a rule in their personal appearances, although he did play other instruments in their recording sessions. And just above the guitar, and slightly to the right, stands a red-headed doll, supposedly symbolizing a mourning Jane Asher, whom Paul was dating at the time of his death. Immediately to the left of the doll is a stone bust, purportedly Paul's father. Both the doll and the bust look into the grave. To the extreme left of the grave, within itself, is a small Buddha in an icon-like setting. The significance of the Buddha is beyond us, but what is more puzzling is the Enfield rifle and the bayonet that rests on the shrine. And immediately below it protrudes the blade of a knife. Above all this, there's a doll. She's perched on the knee of a man wearing a ski sweater and a knitted cap. On the doll's leg, the right one, a small model of a car, a corgi toy, it's believed, also believed to be an Aston Martin. And to the left of the doll's left leg is a driver's glove, the left one, bloody. Remember, McCartney is left-handed. It also appears McCartney's taller in the picture than any of the rest of the Beatles. In the grouping of the statues from the waxworks, he appears to be taller only than Ringo Starr. And taking into account the lack of depth perception and the angle of the photograph, mathematicians tell WKBW that he is indeed shorter than either Harrison or Lennon. And yet in the central grouping, he's the tallest, despite the fact that Harrison wears a three-cornered hat that would give him increased height. The people who surround him in the picture have, for the most part, either died or had close brushes with death or have dealt in black magic in some form or another. This is not a generalization, but a fact, and documented. The figure immediately to the rear of McCartney, the one whose face is partially obscured, is reported to be Stephen Crane, an American author whose book, The Red Badge of Courage, is still today considered a classic. It seems rather strange that when you look into the eyes of this portrait and see the intensity there and notice that the hair appears to be parted in the middle and the fine bridge of the nose, and the face becomes reminiscent of the many portraits of Christ at the Last Supper. Immediately to the front of this purported Crane portrait is a hand raised over McCartney's head. This is the Far East equivalent of the popular halo used to symbolize sanctity among Western churches and never subscribed to one who is alive. This hand, or others like it, appear quite often in following albums and pictures of McCartney. And now turning to the inside cover of Sgt. Pepper, we find the four apparently seated. Notice the braid on all the others. Ringo's trimmed in gold, John's in orange, Harrison's in white, McCartney's in black. He wears a patch on his arm, and although the first two letters are readily distinguishable, the third is not. It's presumed that these three letters read OPD. The English police equivalent of DOA, dead on arrival, officially pronounced dead. He also wears a decoration in the center of his tunic that's awarded by the British Army for heroic death. And as you might suspect, it is always awarded posthumously. This decoration is not to be confused with the Order of the British Empire that he wears on his lower left breast. To the back of the cover, we find three Beatles facing the camera and Paul with his back to the lens. Two of them, Starr and Lennon, stand with their hands in postures of repose, Ringo with them clasped in front of his stomach, and John with his stuffed into his waistband. Harrison's, meantime, are quite active, even in this still shot. He points with deliberate casualness to a line in the lyrics that read, Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, the significance of which will be brought into play in the next album. Enter Mr. Billy Shears. The bottom four lines of the album title song, so let me introduce to you the one and only Billy Shears and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And this is the only point in the LP where they go immediately right into another cut, which is With a Little Help from My Friends.
What would you think if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends.
This lyric is particularly significant, if not for content, then for the way in which they get into it. They're implying that something has changed, but help is on the way, and all will be well. The Beatles, by the way, say that With a Little Help from My Friends is a tribute to the times when they overcame the pressures of the world with drugs. But as you know by now, the drug habit had been kicked at this time. Other lyrics of Sgt. Pepper are important as well. I'm Getting Better, ascribed by the Beatles to a frequent onlooker at recording sessions whose hue and cry was, It's getting better. Or how about Fixing a hole where the rain's getting in and stops my mind from wandering. But the most important, aside from Sgt. Pepper, to With a Little Help from My Friends, is A Day in the Life. The Beatles say this particular song was written from the newspaper. Paul wrote the melody, John brought out the words. It chronicles for us the mixed feelings they must have had upon learning of McCartney's death. They just finished their guru experience. He taught them death was not to be feared, but welcomed. This accounts for the lines, Well, I just had to laugh. A lucky man had made the grade. The importance of the lyrical content of this song cannot be overemphasized. And equally important is the funereal quality of the music that accompanies it.
I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. Didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure he was on the house floor. I saw a film today, oh boy.
In the parlophone version of the Sgt. Pepper album, that is the album as released in England, there are some voices in the dry groove on side two. If you were listening on a turntable that had a normal automatic reject, you'd not hear it. The arm would reject before it got to it. However, on broadcast equipment, where rejection of a record is manual, we were able to pick it out of the dry groove immediately next to the label. Played forward, it sounds like... Lucy Abbey All the Way. Listen again. Lucy Abbey All the Way. Admittedly, that makes very little sense. However, if you play it backwards, it sounds like, And we'll all be back here soon. Strange. WKBW's presentation of Paul McCartney is Alive and Well. Maybe. We'll continue in a moment on WKBW 1520 Buffalo.
No one from Apple wants to talk. For those of you who saw recent pictures of McCartney, there's always the look-alike contest. Let's turn to Magical Mystery Tour. Here's an abortive attempt at filming for the Beatles, roundly booed and panned and criticized by the critics. However, the album, that's another story, a massive success, and fair hunting ground for anyone with a nose for clues. The album, Magical Mystery Tour, includes a full-color 24-page booklet that's filled to bursting with clues. Now, let's depart from our script for just a moment. This is the first time that the Beatles have included any sort of massive visual reference in their LPs. Help was a motion picture, later released in an album form, the music of it was, and there was no booklet included with that. Hard Day's Night was also a motion picture, released in album form, the soundtrack of which was released in album form. There was no booklet with that. All of a sudden, Magical Mystery Tour comes along with a full-color 24-page booklet that is filled with significant death clues. Why? Let's look at the front cover. Four animals appear, three at the top, all in white. The walrus at the bottom, all in black, and is in a posture of supplication or crucifixion. The teeth of the walrus, large and protruding. A sign? Well, one could safely say that being involved in an accident where there was major damage to the car and the person, that in all likelihood, the teeth of the driver would be in jeopardy. Any significance there? Well, now, above the animals, or the Beatles, is the name Beatles, spelled out in stars. When you hold this cover to the mirror, there's a telephone number concealed in the stars that just leaps right out at you. The number, 237-7038. Now, you refer back to Sergeant Pepper for the time to call, and George Harrison gives you the clue. Wednesday morning, 5 o'clock, as the day begins. On page 3, McCartney in military uniform is seated at a desk. On the front of the desk is a prominent sign that says, I, you, was. And the I and was, both larger than the you. There are crossed flags immediately to the rear of McCartney's head in this picture. Crossed flags in English military history have always indicated military death or heroic death, and are a prominent sight at English military burials. And in the home, they are equivalent to the gold star so many American homes display. On his left breast, he wears a series of ribbons. The one trimmed in black is that one that is awarded for heroic military death and always, quite naturally, posthumously. Page 4. McCartney and Ringo Starr appear. The basic tone of the picture is red. McCartney holds a writing stick in his right hand. Remember, he's left-handed. Page 5. This picture shows 15 men and women dressed in white, indicating the medical profession. They all wear head bandages, indicating damage to the head. The animals are grouped to the front of the picture and play their instruments. Now, there are moments of conflict here, but we'll return to those in just a moment or so. Moving on to page 8, a table is in the sign of the cross and a picture that someone will construe to be a parody of the Last Supper. Considering the religious implications the entire group has shown to this point, this may indeed be very plausible. Going to page 10, a taller McCartney, remember he is supposed to be shorter than everyone but Ringo Starr. Here, a taller McCartney is grouped with his mates, and unlike the others, wears no shoes. We're told, and have investigated the fact, that the English traditionally bury without shoes, and in some parts of this country, meaning the United States, that custom is held to, and in others it is not. It appears to be the custom of perhaps the undertaker, or maybe even the wishes of the family. Page 12 shows the group on stage holding their instruments. McCartney, his left-handed bass, George lead guitar, Lennon at piano, and Ringo at drums. All wear shoes with the exception of McCartney, who is in stocking feet. His shoes stand beside the bass drum and directly beneath the tom-tom. Empty shoes are significant. We know that Lennon is undergoing a deep religious experience at this time. We know that he has gone through several periods in the past 2 or 3 years that have led him to believe that death is to be welcomed and not feared. We know also that he has made a fetish of death, studying the various customs and cultures of other lands. The empty shoes are the Greek equivalent of the American funeral wreath. It started in early Grecian days when empty sandals would be placed outside the door of a Greek household and would say to the neighbors roundabout, our son has died in battle. Well, this custom has lingered in Greece folk culture and peasant customs. And again, the English traditionally do not bury with the shoes on. Another point here. The definition of the picture is slightly grainy. This is probably a technique used by the photographer or the developer. But the color definition is good. There's no bleeding of colors from one to another. They are firm and they are constant. However, the shoes beside the drum carry red spots that look as though they were applied later on. Perhaps an accident with chemicals. Perhaps. Perhaps a deliberate attempt to show blood. And further, strengthen our case. Page 14. The only thing here is McCartney seated at a desk, while on the desk is a swagger stick. It lies at his right hand. Page 23. The Beatles have descended a long staircase and all wear white formal costumes. All wear red carnations with the exception of McCartney. He wears black and carries a bouquet of flowers in his right hand. Page 24 shows an assemblage of people seated on some steps. The Beatles are at the top of the steps. McCartney is in the center. Immediately behind McCartney's head is a hand. And from the posture of the man extending his arm, look closely now. If you look on the one side, it's very natural. The elbow is crooked very naturally and the hand is raised very naturally. On the other, it's a bit of a reach. Pre-planned? Who knows? Magical Mysteries Tour music. It's quite revealing. All of the lyrics lend themselves to a death interpretation. But the most damning of the lot is one called Fool on the Hill. From the naked surface of the LPs, the words, they leap out at you. Listen.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him. They can see that he's just a fool, and he never gives an answer. But the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
Day after day, alone on the hill, the man with a foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. Now perhaps that this particular lyric does not imply physical death. Perhaps it implies spiritual death, or closer to the point, perhaps it implies some sort of mental death. Listen. Magical Mystery Tour. As we said, it's quite revealing, and that's Fool on the Hill. Let us take you to I Am the Walrus. Here the reference is made to Edgar Allan Poe. Edgar, known as the Eggman. We also know that Poe, in addition to dealing in horror with the stories he wrote, was also a necromaniac, a person who conjures the spirits of the dead for purposes of revealing the future. In I Am a Walrus, there are references to Thanks to Number Nine. In numerology, number nine is the death number. And we've had passing acquaintance with number nine before. We'll bring it back. I wish I were dead, is said in I Am a Walrus. And the most prominent is the passage from King Lear. What? Is he dead? Sit you down, father, rest you. Bury the body. There are references to telegrams and things of that sort. Some of it is very difficult to pick out because of the multi-tracking that the Beatles do. They record anywhere from 8 to 16 tracks. On your average stereo, you can only isolate one or two channels. We have been able to isolate some of the channels, and we've come up with some very interesting things. The end of Walrus, for instance, played backward and isolated to a degree, is rather enlightening. The rhythm is established by the group saying, ha, ha, Paul is dead. Ha, ha, Paul is dead. Ha, ha, Paul is dead. Physically or mentally? Let's listen. Even more significant, perhaps, is in a song from this particular album called Strawberry Fields Forever. We'll hear about Strawberry Fields Forever in a little while in another album, in perhaps a more pertinent way. But at the end of Strawberry Fields Forever, if you isolate track one from track two, you'll hear someone say, I buried Paul. Now, to show you what's happening, if you cannot do it on your stereo, if you cannot isolate it, we're going to play it for you once with one speaker turned off, so that you can only hear one channel, the channel the voice is not on. We'll play that for you now. This is where it would normally be heard. It's not there. Now what we'll do is activate the other channel for you so the vocal portion of it will come in. Listen for I Buried Paul. We'll play this at 33, which is not the correct speed. They used a variable speed turntable here because when you play it at 45, as we will in a later moment, you'll see that the voice is much higher pitched than natural. This is at 33. We're activating the other channel. Listen for I Buried Paul. Now, that's rather slow, and as we said, they're using a variable speed turntable or a variable speed tape recording machine. Let's listen again at 45. Loud and clear. I Buried Paul. And again. Musically, Magical Mystery Tour is perhaps the most significant of the LPs that we're going to look at tonight, and we'll go on to the album The Beatles. In a moment, WKBW is presenting Paul McCartney as Alive and Well, Maybe. We'll continue in a moment from WKBW Radio 1520 Buffalo. In the album The Beatles, the stark white cover should tell you something. Does it mean sanctity, sanctification, the purification of death? Does it mean perhaps the purification of someone who is mentally injured, with no cares and no concerns and no worries? It should tell us something. The pictures that we draw are our own. The collage inside the album tells you other things. The picture at the lower left-hand corner of the collage, for instance, shows a man that we've never seen before. This is William Campbell, the winner of the look-alike contest. It's obvious, too, that the picture was an afterthought, or at least meant to be discovered. Notice the strip of pictures that it appears with, or all the way that you would receive proofs from a photographer. They have the ratchet keys on the side, the guide, I think photographers call it. And yet Campbell's snapshot is obviously placed there and heavily outlined in a black border. Other pictures of Paul with the top of his head cropped off by the photographer. Some is technique. Others poorly done and serve no artistic purpose whatever, but they do serve the purpose of making the suspicious even more so. The music of this album is more important than the pictures, actually. It reveals more. Dear Prudence, a nickname for Paul used by John Lennon in their early days. Listen to the lyrical content. Dear Prudence, won't you come out to play? It's a brand new day. Open up your eyes. See the sunny skies. Dear Prudence. Down, down, down. Dear Prudence, from the album The Beatles. Then, there's Glass Onion. The lyric. I've told you about Strawberry Hill. You know, the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go where everything flows. Look into the big black tulips. See how the other half lives. Look into a glass onion. I've told you about the walrus and me now. Well, here's another clue for you all. The walrus is Paul. I've told you about the fool on the hill. I tell you, man, he's living there still. Well, here's another place you can be. Listen to me. Fixing a hole in the ocean. Trying to make a dovetail joint. Look into the glass onion.
I told you about Strawberry Field. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go. Where everything grows.
Here's another place you can be. Listen to me. Fixing a hole in the ocean. Trying to make a dovetail joint. Look into the glass onion. Let's take a look at this song, Glass Onion, for a moment. First, we are told that the Beatles know we are looking for clues, and they're going to help us, but they won't go too far. We're told that the walrus is Paul. The line, I believe, reads, "The walrus was Paul." Now, we've isolated this particular line on tape cartridge, and you listen for what we're about to tell you to listen for. The next line after "the walrus is Paul" is garbled somewhat. Listen.
The walrus was Paul.
Now, the walrus is Paul, standing on a cast something or other. We think that they may have gone too far here and made a tape edit. And perhaps not quite by accident. Perhaps it's done deliberately, because so far this entire thing has been done with a great deal of skill and a great deal of style. But now, all of a sudden, there is an edit that is plainly audible to anyone who has an ear for production techniques. Listen again, you'll see what I mean. Standing on a cast iron, and then the music jumps a bit. They've edited and they've left out a beat. Listen.
The walrus was Paul. Standing on the cast iron, yeah.
Now, what does the cast something or other have to do with it? Standing on a cast something or other. Well, when you place a man in a grave, he goes in the casket or coffin. But first, there's a cast aluminum or cast iron vault that goes in to act as a receptacle for the coffin.
The walrus was Paul. Standing on the cast iron, yeah.
Standing on a cast iron what? Standing on a cast aluminum what? Who knows? Moving to fixing a hole in the ocean, trying to make a dovetail joint. A dovetail joint is that in the brow of a ship, the bow that holds things together, much as your skullcap does. Fixing a hole in the ocean. Interesting. While My Guitar Gently Weeps, also from the album The Beatles, aside from the lines that say, "I don't know how much you were inverted," While My Guitar Gently Weeps does really not have a great deal to contribute. That is, until you begin to isolate tracks and until you begin to listen. There's really not much there, except for the phrase at the end where, quite prominently, the words, rather plaintively, "Oh, Paul," are repeated in the tune this lovely melody is set to. Let's listen. My Guitar Gently Weeps. To save time so we can move along, let's move right to the passage. Oh, Paul. Someone moaning, "Oh, Paul," in the tune While My Guitar Gently Weeps from the album The Beatles. Would you like to hear it again? Oh, Paul. Then there's Revolution Number 9, Number 9 being the numerologist number for death. In this song, the hand of Lennon is seen more strongly, more graphically than ever before. The mere tempo of the music bears his name, the stamp of small things joined together with no apparent rhyme or reason or rhythm is his conception of music, and he said so. Revolution Number 9 contains many clues for the wary, and we'll enumerate them in a moment. As we continue with Paul McCartney is alive and well, maybe, on WKBW 1520 Buffalo. Revolution Number 9 starts with the now famous Number 9.
Number 9.
Number 9.
Number 9. Number 9. Number 9. Number 9.
Which, of course, played backwards, comes out to be "Turn Me On, Deadman."
Turn Me On, Deadman.
Turn Me On, Deadman.
Turn Me On, Deadman. Turn Me On, Deadman. Turn Me On, Deadman. Turn Me yonder, man.
From this illustrious piece of musical composition, we progress through a cacophony of sounds that include crackling cellophane, police sirens amplified and echoed, mumbling and talking, some distinct, some not quite so distinct, fire, war, cheers, and hold that line, block that kick, and also some things that are rather pertinent on all 16 tracks of Mumbo Jumbo. There's a Requiem Mass, Fauré's Requiem. It's conducted by George Martin with the orchestra and chorus of St. Eustace Church in London, England. And if you listen closely as we progress through this cut, you'll hear the Kyrie. And there's also dialogue. The dialogue is rather revealing in the midst of all of this cacophonous sound. Now why, with all of the talent and all of the artistic and creative ability that they possess, why would the Beatles grind out 5 minutes of pure and utter cacophony? Because they wanted to put something in for you to listen for. That's what. We are going to isolate the channels. We're going to let you hear the dialogue. Listen to the man say something, something about the pallbearer, the telegram. Who could tell what he was saying? His voice was low and his eyes were glassy. Let's listen.
With the situation,
they are standing still.
Listen now, for my wings are broken and so is my hair. I'm not in the mood for words.
I'm broken, chair. My wings are broken and so is my hair. I am not in the mood for words.
Fire. He must have gotten it through the shoulder blades.
May it serve you well.
They say that. And they also say, he's hit a light pole. We'd better get him to a surgeon. So anyhow, he went to see a dentist who instead gave him a pair of teeth that weren't any good at all. So he joined the Navy and went to sea. Slightly reminiscent of a walrus. Slow, ponderous voice that says, my wings are broken and so is my hair. I'm not in the mood for words.
Another voice that says, find the night watchman. Another that says, a fine natural imbalance. Does that lend credence to the theory that he may have suffered brain damage and is alive but not entirely well? And a last voice that says, he must have gotten it between the shoulder blades. Listen to these passages at home if you are capable of isolating channels on your stereo set, and you'll see precisely what we mean. Abbey Road is the next album, and most of the clues are visual. The four figures striding across the street, Abbey Road. On the left, a graveyard, and a Volkswagen with a licensed plate number, LMW28IF. 28, if alive. Across the street is a Black Maria. We had the license plate blown up from the picture on Abbey Road and presented to our London Bureau of Fairchild Broadcast News Service. They confirm that it is indeed a Black Maria, a meat wagon from the London morgue. And they also confirm that LMW28IF is a genuine automotive plate in England. It is not one that was made specifically for the occasion. They are unable to determine the name of the owner. The Bureau of Statistics or the registration people in London are not willing to give out that information. The four figures, white, sanctification, purification, black, mourning, perhaps presiding at a service, which indeed, according to the story, Ringo Starr was supposed to have done. The corpse and the grave digger. And again, McCartney appears without shoes. And again, he carries a cigarette in his right hand. We all know that he's left-handed. And the suit is old-fashioned. It has cuffs. The legs are baggy. They're not tapered at all, completely unlike the clothing the others wear. The last medley on the second side, Golden Slumbers. Carry that weight. The end. Turn the album over to the back. Turn it sideways. Notice between Beatles and Abbey Road runs a long piece of concrete that strangely resembles a spinal column. Particularly significant in view of Maxwell's silver hammer, Dr. Maxwell was a noted pathologist who discovered the presence of fluid in the spinal column. And finally, there's Come Together, the lead song in the album. Side one, cut one, from the Beatles' newest album, Abbey Road. Some of the lines in this particular LP, or in this particular song, are rather significant. The one about, he wears no shoe shine. Paul McCartney wears no shoes, so it's obvious his shoes could not be shine. We all know that the English custom is to bury people without shoes. He has hair down to his knees. He has a monkey finger. Hair and nails. A protean. Hair and nails grow after death. People who have been exhumed because of inquests or some doubt as to the validity of the death certificates, why coroners and people of that nature have been astounded by the growth of hair and the growth of nails after the body has been interred into a grave. Hair down to his knees, no shoe shine, monkey finger. And you know he's just got to be free as only death can make a man.
He got early warning, he got muddy water, he wants more joy.
One and one and one is three. Three remaining Beatles. Got to be good looking. McCartney was undoubtedly the best looking of the Beatles, but he's tough to see right now. Together over me. Let's move from Abbey Road. There's another LP, one that's called Get Back, the newest of the LPs. We do not have the album cover of Get Back, so we cannot really draw any visual conclusions. But there is one track that leads to a lyrical conclusion. The hymn-like quality of Let It Be, So Be It, Amen, leads one to believe the joke has perhaps gone too far. The line, there is still the chance that they will see that there will be an answer. Let it be. So be it. Amen. WKBW's presentation of Paul McCartney is alive and well, maybe. We'll continue in a moment. It seems rather conclusive. Paul McCartney is dead.
As for Paul McCartney, he's alive and well, and unconcerned about rumors of his death.
Derek Taylor, press officer of the Beatles and Apple Records.
Everyone's uptight about this. It's a negative trip, this is. It's a very bad trip for everyone. It's death, and it doesn't have any point. It doesn't have any purpose. It's a death trip, and it's no good, and it leads you into nothing.
George Martin, arranger, producer for the Beatles.
He's alive and well, and with his wife and their two children, and the dog, Martha, Ringo. And Paul and their wives went to see Mary Hopkin at the Savoy. Well, there were numerous press people there. His way of life continues normally. He goes to see his father. He goes to soccer matches. He does the McCartney things. He is McCartney.
John Lennon, charter member of the Beatles.
It's just a little story, that's all it is. You know, it's a short story.
Mike McGeer, Paul's brother.
Yes, he died in an earthquake in Mexico in 1917. No, actually, it's my baby that is doubling for him. My little baby girl will be the fourth Beatle soon.
Lois Eastman, Paul's sister-in-law.
I can't understand it at all, to tell you the truth. I think it's a lot of reading in, and it's really stupid. I can't really understand it, to tell you the truth.
Dr. Oscar Tossi, audiologist, University of Michigan, who compared a recent supposed McCartney interview with an older, genuine one. Although he says it may be the same person, he's quick to point out that it is by no means conclusive.
I am directing an experiment to check for the reliability of the method. This experiment is funded by the Department of Justice and is not yet completed. However, with the samples that we obtained, there are good chances that it's the same person.
Now, would there be any change in a person's voice as he grew older?
Well, if the person is an adult, I don't think that the change is significant, because the vocal tract is maintained more or less in the same size and elasticity and so forth, in the same way that the face of a person could change through the years because the different type of tissues and so, but will not change drastically.
And then there's John Lennon, who says,
it's just a little story, that's all it is. You know, it's a short story.
And of course, we would be remiss if we did not present Paul McCartney.
I was barefooted because it was a nice day. And if it's a nice day, I don't like wearing shoes. I wore a black carnation on Magical Mystery Tour, and the other three wore red. The reason for that is that they didn't have any more red ones. And I just got handed a black one, so I stuck that in my buttonhole, you know.
If the conclusion you reach is that I'm dead, then you're wrong. Because I'm alive and living in Scotland.
Thank you, Mr. McCartney. Where did it start? Well, so far there are three reports. One, a student in Ohio. He cannot be found, nor can he be identified. A student at the University of Delaware. His name is John Summer. He supposedly submitted a thesis pertaining to the death rumor. Our investigators have been unable to turn up a John Summer or John Sumner who submitted any such thesis at any university or college in Delaware. The third source is Fred Labor, writing for the Michigan Daily. He would not consent to having his voice used on our air. However, we can report on the interview. Mr. Labor, where did you get the idea for the material and the article?
I was looking at the LPs, and some of the things had begun to fall in place. I heard a rumor concerning his death, or death amongst the Beatles, and it all pointed to Paul.
After this, there was some conversation about the factualness of some of the statements made, and he was rather vague concerning their origin. One point was made. You state in the article that you are grateful for the assistance of Marianne Martin, illegitimate daughter of George Martin, arranger and producer of all the Beatles records. Where did this information come from?
Well, I made that one up.
So much for the credibility of Mr. Labor's article. Going further in our rebuttal, it's claimed that only five people know of the tragedy and the plot to keep it a secret. They are, in order of importance, John Lennon, George Martin, Ringo Starr, George Harrison, and the late Brian Epstein. The arithmetic formula used to arrive at this number does not coincide with ours. What of the police? What of the garage man who hauled away the car? Certainly someone hauled it away. What of the bystanders? It occurred in the city. What of the coroner? What of the Bureau of Statistics, who must issue a death and burial permit? What of Jane Asher? According to Labor, she was bought off. The coroner never appeared. And the absence of a death permit means, he says rather sinisterly, he must be buried illegally. McCartney is said to have left the studios in his Aston Martin in a fit of anger. Again, our London bureau comes into play. They say that McCartney did not purchase an Aston Martin until just after the first of the year 1967. Furthermore, why should he drive off into the night to drive home? He lives less than two blocks from the recording studios. The American Safety Council would have us believe that most accidents occur within 25 miles of home. Be that as it may, what of the look-alike contest? The fact exists. There is a William Campbell. He did win the contest. He cannot be found today. It is a fact. We cannot find him, nor can anyone else. That cannot be discounted. However, John Lennon says,
it's a little story, that's all it is. It's a short story.
The clue is in all the LPs, John, the visual ones and the lyrical ones. What's the explanation for all those things?
It's a little story, that's all it is. It's a short story.
Thank you, John. He also says, quote, we're a con as well. We know we're conning them because we know people want to be conned. They've given us the freedom to con them. Let's stick that in there, we say. That'll start them puzzling. I'm sure all the artists do when they realize it's a con. I bet Picasso sticks things in. Right in your ear, John. End of quote.
It's just a little story, that's all it is. It's a short story.
It may be a con, but we frankly doubt if there is a coincidence. What of Billy Shears? We can't find him, nor can we find any person of fame that bears that name. We cannot find anyone at Apple or any of their related offices who are even willing to admit the man is alive or indeed ever existed. We do know, however, that up until a couple of weeks ago, the telephone number on the front cover of Magical Mystery Tour in London was billed to one William Shears. However, his mailing address and the signature that was attached to the checks in response to the invoices from the phone company are not known to us, nor will they give us that information, the telephone utility, that is. We do know that now the number is no longer registered to Billy Shears. It is now registered to a reporter employed by the Manchester Guardian. On the inside booklet, page 5, the walrus plays the piano, and the left-handed hippo plays bass. The walrus is supposed to be Paul, and yet there is a hippo playing bass. Sounds like Dr. Seuss. Again, on page 10, McCartney wears his watch on the right hand. And on pages 12 and 13, we see McCartney playing bass and Lennon seated at the piano. Now, it might appear that the walrus is not really Paul at all, but Lennon. And the fact that walrus is supposed to mean corpse in Greek is not really true. Potomo nekron soma means corpse in Greek, while walrus in Greek is aeolphus. I'm certain it loses something in the translation, but no matter. It's all Greek to us anyway. McCartney's tailor, Doug Howard, contacted by us but refusing to consent to an interview, told us only that he fitted McCartney for a suit just 8 days ago. George Martin says that he knows nothing about it. All of the Beatles are incommunicado. No one is willing to say anything. Stan Roberts, KB Morning personality, talked to a friend, Lee Gray, who knew McCartney on the first tour and has seen him many times since. Their conversation went this way.
I was up all night. I went out to Central Park about 6:20, 6:30 in the morning. And I was walking through the park. And I ran into Paul McCartney and Linda, the former Miss Linda Eastman. And I had seen Paul and known Paul from other times when I was on Beatles trips with him. We took some people over to London to meet him. I knew him in Hamburg, Germany. I used to MC things for him up there back in 62. And so anyway, he recognized me, and we sat on the grass, 6:30 in the morning, a Tuesday morning last May, talking. And he recalled some things he was telling Linda about, some things that he thought that were funny, that only Paul McCartney would know. Things like one day at the Odeon Hammersmith Theater, which is a theater in the suburbs of London.
Mm-hmm.
I came out of the water closet, or the bathroom.
Yes.
And my fly was undone. And Paul told me about it. And I zipped it back up, of course. And then he unzipped it again and said, it looks better that way. Which is a funny little side thing that nobody would know about.
What conclusion can we come to? We can see McCartney's pictures in the papers, but there's always the look-alike contest. And the fact exists that the winner of the contest cannot be found, or perhaps does not want to be found. There are the voice graphs done by Dr. Tossey at Michigan State. He claims that the voices are the same. But Dr. Tossey was working from only one word that he was able to match, the word song. And although he claims this evidence is enough to establish the man's identity, it is not in a court of law. The law requires that 10 words must match before they can even be admitted as evidence in court. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, has established a pattern of vocal fingerprints that they say match conclusively. But by the same token, a University of Miami professor has said that musical comparisons he has made do not. Dr. Henry Truby, director of the university's Language and Linguistics Research Department, put the McCartney riddle to the so-called sound fingerprint test. After 20 hours of running experiments on dozens of Beatle records dating back from the early 60s to now, the professor said there is reasonable doubt that three voices popularly attributed to McCartney are produced by the same set of vocal chords. I hear three different McCartneys.
On the basis of the song plus music, that is singing voice plus musical background analysis, that's the only way I can describe it, because that's what it is, I have not been able to say that there were less than three voices, all of which were, according to Mr. Century, attributed on the label song to McCartney. And we did look very carefully at the vocal output on these songs and on these selections, and these were my conclusions.
Dr. Truby says, I cannot conclude that the same voice appears in these early and late passages. Dr. Truby, by the way, has spent 20 years studying audio studies scientifically. Jean Dixon, the woman who predicted the death of the Kennedys, also predicted that one of the Beatles would die in a plane crash, the unlikely candidate, Ringo Starr. A Philadelphia article quoted Mrs. Dixon as saying that McCartney is the devil's disciple. KB's Dan Nevereth spoke with her.
I meditated on Paul McCartney the other day, and I do not get that that he's been killed in an automobile crash of any kind.
Do you, Mrs. Dixon, do you detect any kind of a problem within the group?
Oh, there's a problem in the group. There's been problems there for quite a little while, and they're not as closely knit as they used to be by any matter of means. I forecast a long time ago that they were going to try to bring an Eastern religion to the West, you see. However, I do not believe that Paul agrees with them on that kind of religion.
So then there could possibly be some symbolism that they have pronounced him spiritually dead?
Yes, spiritually, yes, but not physically.
What is your opinion of this affair? From the men who have chased down the clues and have been intimately involved, what do people like Dan Nevereth have to say?
My immediate reaction to the McCartney puzzle was, sure, why not? These guys are capable of almost anything. And if anybody could pull off a massive deception like this, it would be somebody like them. They certainly had the necessary funds, they had secluded mansions, and to all appearances, they had the minds to find a certain amount of satisfaction from hatching a plot like this. But then, after spending many hours, too many hours, sifting, sorting, and listening, and arguing, and we did do some arguing, I felt that this surely could not be this thing that everybody felt, this feeling that McCartney was dead. I didn't feel that it could be, but I did feel that the mountains of evidence were far too great in volume alone to be just a series of coincidences. So I think that the Beatles, in the past few years, have very consciously laid the groundwork for the event that we're exploring tonight. And incidentally, the sale of their old albums has increased tremendously. You just try to buy a copy of Sgt. Pepper at the corner record store. I honestly feel that right now they're laughing. I really do. I think they're laughing. But I think it's a pretty sick laugh.
Or KB's Stan Roberts.
My reaction to, is Paul McCartney dead? I don't think that Paul McCartney is dead, literally. I don't think that anybody, no matter how macabre their sense of humor would be, could possibly make a joke or put hints or lead up to disclosing someone's death this way. But on the other hand, I think there are just too many coincidences, too many clues in the albums to have it mean nothing at all. I think the Beatles are trying to tell us something. What it is, I don't know. If it means their old style of music is dead, if it means that his mind has gone blank for a while. What it does mean, I'm not sure of that. I think artistically, something is dead. But Paul McCartney, I'm pretty certain he is alive and well.
The evidence clearly is circumstantial. How many doubts have we put to rest in your minds? In our own. The majority of the feeling with people outside of the Beatles and Apple organization is that McCartney is indeed alive and well. However, they all feel, almost to the man, that this mass of symbolic evidence does lead somewhere. They do not feel that it is, as Apple and the Beatles would have you believe, coincidental. They do feel that it is planned. They do feel that there is an end to this path. It leads to something traumatic that has occurred within this group, whether it be physical or spiritual or even artistically. At this point in time, it's difficult to say where the answer lies. There are many forks in the path and no road signs to go by. One thing all these clues have in common is this. They bear the hand of a man who has a grotesque sense of humor. They bear the hand of a man who's capable of quick changes of action and motion and mind. They bear the hand of a man who has made a study of the cultures of death. They bear the unalterable hand of John Lennon. We know that Paul McCartney is alive and well. We know that John Lennon is alive.
It's just a little story, that's all it is. You know, it's a short story.
And then there's the dialogue from side one on the LP, Get Back. Sure is different with McCartney here.
Just different at this time.
Could we hear that again? Sure is different with McCartney here.
Just different at this time.
And maybe just one more once.
Just different at this time.
So, there you have it.
Paul McCartney is alive and well. Maybe.